Okay, here we are. We are now in chapter 16 of the Bhagavad Gita. There are only 18 chapters, I know. I don't know what we'll do when this is over. This has sort of become such an integral part of our lives. We could start over and I don't think we'd say one word the same. Okay, we are on chapter 29 of the commentary, the nature of the godly and the demonic. This is worth knowing, isn't it? Okay. Chapter 16, verse 1 of the Gita. The Blessed Lord said, fearlessness, purity of heart, perseverance in the acquisition of wisdom and in the practice of meditation, sattvic charity, self-restraint, the performance of holy rites, symbolic self-offering to God and to the devas, service to holy persons, and agnihotra, pouring oblations into the sacred fire, study of the scriptures, self-discipline, straightforwardness, harmlessness, truthfulness, freedom from anger, renunciation, tranquility, disinclination toward fault-finding, kindness to all, non-covetousness, gentleness, modesty, not calling attention to oneself, steadfastness of purpose, radiance of character, forgiveness, fortitude, cleanliness, absence of malice, absence of self-conceit. These qualities, O descendant of Bharata, Arjuna, are the endowments of those who are divinely inclined. And that is our whole section for tonight, that long, wonderful list. I have a friend who raised, I think, 8 children. And for a certain period of that time, she was a single mom. And she never really wanted, she was a very disciplined person, but she never really wanted to be the bad guy in the life of her children. So she actually took the yamas and the niyamas, you know, the 10 commandments of yoga, the first two of Patanjali's Eightfold Path, non-attachment, non-covetousness, and various words that were all attributes of the spiritual path, and she put them up on the refrigerator. And then whenever there was any dispute or disagreement or the belief in her mind that her children had transgressed in some way, that done something that they shouldn't have done, they would all go to the refrigerator. They wouldn't be actually her who would be telling them that they were wrong. They would all go to the refrigerator, because on the refrigerator were these list of qualities, and then they would have a discussion about whether or not they had adhered to the qualities that were on the refrigerator, and the refrigerator actually became the primary disciplining force in the household. But what was so marvelous about the whole thing was that those qualities, which is not exactly what we're talking about now, but it's not unrelated, just sort of this statement of this is what a dharmic and a virtuous person does. This is what someone does who is living their life according to high principles, and then all situations will be covered by it if the list is sufficient. Of course, the yamas and the niyamas are. They're the things, the positive things that you do and those things that you restrain yourself from. In this case also, people often ask the question, how can I tell whether I'm progressing spiritually? And in the Bible, when someone asked Jesus, how can you tell a true prophet from a false prophet, which is a similar sort of question, how do we evaluate that which is subtle? He gave the wonderful answer, common sense answer, you can tell by the fruits. The actions have results. And you can look at what's being manifested, and then you can tell whether the cause that went into it is the right cause. And so in our own spiritual lives, so often we have this idea, we're looking for some kind of measurable element. I was so amused many, many years ago. I think it was the magazine then called Yoga Journal. I think it may have, maybe it's still called Yoga Journal. But in any case, they had an article and it was called, actually, I believe the actual title was The Dark Side of Meditation. You know, it's sort of like you have to always find something negative. This is an actual true story. A very dear friend of ours, an Indian woman, who was a friend of Ananda, her whole family was friends of our community, and she was getting her master's degree at Berkeley in journalism, And she chose as her subject to write about Ananda. So she, you know, she was a very intelligent woman. She did a very cogent research project. But when she turned it into her professor didn't think it was well done because there was insufficient criticism. She hadn't found enough things that were wrong. So she tried to find more things that were wrong. So she talked about that the roads weren't paved at that time, and then there was a lot of mud in the winter. But she actually, her thesis was never accepted because the professor was convinced that because there wasn't something horrible about what she was researching, her research was insufficient. Isn't that just the most terrible way that people orient their minds? Well, I had a purpose in bringing that up. Let me think what it was. Yes, the dark side of meditation. Thank you. The dark side of meditation was that so many people are drawn to meditation because they're overachievers, and they're what people would call type A personalities, if people still use that word. People are very intense about everything that they do and competitive and anxious to succeed and determined. And they get into meditation, and the purpose of meditation is to be perfect in meditation and to realize God. And so the pressure to realize God becomes just one more stress in their life. That was how it was described. Yeah, I mean, let's reach hard to find a problem. But of course, it is the truth. In fact, someone said that to me once. I mean, what could be more overwhelming than the pressure to be perfect? Be therefore perfect as our Father in heaven is perfect. It's a pretty tall order. You can worry about that for a really, really long time. And so that was the danger of meditation. Well, we do have this inclination to want to feel that we're doing the right thing. And it's often very difficult to really to tell in truth, because just because you're going through a period of bad karma doesn't necessarily mean that you're not progressing spiritually. And sometimes people whose lives are just rolling along and everything seems successful may in fact, as Swami says sometimes, just be using up their good karma, but depending on what they're doing internally is whether or not they're at the same time progressing. They might just be rolling along on past momentum. And individuals who might be just holding on by sheer willpower and scratching their way forward may in fact be finishing out some, you know, very difficult energy, and their courage in the face of those difficulties may in fact be a far greater victory. Now, I'm not trying to make you paranoid, because it's not like, I mean, this kind of thinking can lead to, if you're not suffering, you're not spiritual, and that's really not where I'm trying to go. But what I'm trying to say is it's not that easy to tell, because past karma influences so many things. It's really our inner awareness, and only God really knows, which is why it's just very dangerous to judge. But every so often, in the Bible also, they give us lists. And they give us lists of qualities that are indicative, and many times through the Gita they've said things, you know, to the man of wisdom, a piece of gold, a clod of clay are all the same, praise and blame, all these different, many different times, the man of wisdom, and then there's a whole description. But sometimes it's describing a state of realization toward which we can aspire, but it doesn't necessarily translate as much into our everyday life. Now, what this wonderful list gives us, and then Swami's explanation of each of these, is so extraordinarily subtle that it really tells us sort of what template we can apply to our own attitudes and to the challenges that we face. And having 26 of these qualities, which is also really wonderful, allows us to sort of move around and flow with whatever is going to come most easily to us at any particular time. Master gave a very wonderful piece of advice, which is really worth remembering. Well, let me back it up a little bit. Success in life comes by the development of magnetism. This is an energy universe in which all the forces are dictated by the flow of energy. And Master often says, and in his little book, How to Be a Success, which has just been published, and if you don't have it, I really encourage you to get it. It's a short little compilation of Master's teachings like karma and reincarnation and how to be happy all the time. And How to Be a Success really talks over and over again about the vital importance of always holding a very powerful inner thought that you are a success. And I don't mean by that a sort of naive kind of affirming in the face of all evidence to the contrary, even as you go into bankruptcy court, that really everything is just fine. I don't mean an unrealistic view of life, but an inner sense of your own positive potential that no temporary setback can ever take away from you. Because that's the magnetic force that allows you to just get up and keep going again and again. And eventually, hopefully in this lifetime, or maybe in a future lifetime, if you're really balancing out a lot of karma, but you keep that powerful force going. And in that sense, Swamiji has advised us on many occasions that it's better to go with your strengths. Don't continually do those things where you know you're going to be defeated, because it gets too much into your mind, the thought that you can't succeed. And that has to be balanced with common sense. But the way Master put it is, if a test is greater than you, if you know that you're going to fail a certain test, the best thing to do is to run away from it, which I've always just loved, because there's no point in just standing and being defeated and having that defeat sort of be imprinted on your consciousness. He doesn't mean that you'll really get away with it, but better to go off and learn elsewhere. I know when a friend of mine was getting divorced, and she asked Swamiji, you know, is this karma finished? And basically he said, no such luck. But he said, you've gone as far as you can go with it now, and the only thing to do is to separate and grow in other ways, and then eventually you can come back around and face what you weren't able to deal with at this point. And that's the kind of withdrawal he's talking about, a realistic understanding that I need to train in order to be able to deal with this, not the thought that I'm never going to be able to face it, but that now isn't the moment. So when he gives us these 26 qualities, we can kind of work around which ones are going to be the most effective and which ones are things for us to learn at later dates. This also helps define for us the phrase that we often use at Ananda, which is really one of the fundamental tenets, which is where there is dharma, there is victory. Dharma in this sense means that action which leads to a greater state of awareness. Dharma is often translated as duty, but it's a more subtle word than that. It means doing those things that move you toward higher consciousness. And that is sometimes what is dharma, therefore, for one person may not be dharma for another, because it all depends on where you are standing in relationship to it. If an individual is ready to become a monastic and renounce personal relationships, the personal identity with home and family, that may be, if that's really his true destiny, that would be the forward step for him. If a man is, or a woman, an individual is simply too lazy to take on those responsibilities or too undisciplined to be able to focus their energy and fulfill those responsibilities and tries to say, oh, I think I'll be a renunciate. That's not necessarily a forward step for them. The assumption of family life responsibilities may in fact be progress for them. You know, for some people, having children is a narrowing of their devotion to serving the world. And for others, it's just exactly the impetus needed in order to help them overcome inner reluctances. And so it all depends on where you're standing. But when we say, you know, dharma, too often people think about it too much in terms of external actions. But these qualities, for example, are the description of a person of right action, of how I can live in such a way that I will always be moving my consciousness to a higher level. And in as much as where there is dharma, there is victory, these are very important concepts to keep in mind. Okay, does that make sense? At different times in my life, I've had these lists on my wall. This particular list I've had on my wall, I've had other lists on my wall, just sort of to keep in front of me some kind of idealism, because sometimes the ideals can become a little abstract. But when you're actually looking right at something like perseverance in the acquisition of wisdom and in the practice of meditation, and then you can ask yourself, well, am I? Or have I become lax in my perseverance, you know? Am I fearless? Have I practiced self-restraint? All of these questions. So I thought I would just essentially speak a little bit about each of these qualities, and insofar as you may want, we can have greater discussion about each or any of them. Before I begin running just like that, does anyone have any specific things from reading any of these that you have questions about already. Yes, Darlene?
Where do you speak? Here?
Yeah, the microphone's that little thing at the end.
It's on.
Okay. That's it.
Okay. The part where he talks about kindness and that it's not compassion.
But that was very interesting, wasn't
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that was real.
Yeah.
I didn't really quite get that. So.
Yeah, I thought that was extremely interesting. Okay, that was number 16. And he says, I'll just also actually just read, it's so short, I'll read this one. Partly Swamiji is, he's correcting because in the Sanskrit word is daya, and sometimes the word daya is translated as compassion. And Swamiji wanted to correct that since Dayamata is a very well-known figure in the teaching of self-realization. He wanted to make a point that the difference between the two words and the meaning of the words, because the word in Sanskrit in the Bhagavad Gita is daya. Kindness to all is not compassion, as some people translate the word daya. It would be a distortion of genuine feeling to feel compassionate towards someone who had treated you unkindly, for it would imply condescension, as though you were looking down on him from above. In kindness, there is no pride. In compassion, there might be, especially if you saw to it that others realized how compassionate you were. Kindness means the simple acceptance of others in recognition that they are all, like you, striving for self-improvement. To make the distinction, do you want to just talk about generally, or did you have a specific question there, just in general? You know, if you see somebody who's... The capacity... Let me think now. Let me think exactly how to say it, because I was struck too when I read this. Let me find it again. You can feel compassionate towards someone and not be at all kind to them. I mean, you can really feel sorry for somebody and sympathize with their position, but still be so angry, for example, that you're not able to be kind, or so you can have compassion for them, but at the same time you can judge them or not want to accept, you know, their right to be the way they are. I'm sorry you're suffering for being such a terrible person, but that's just the way it is, you know. You can feel that, but kindness is a spontaneous feeling of the heart where you can't be anything but supportive and forgiving in that feeling. And the other side of it is, when you have compassion for someone, there's also that slight setting yourself apart from them. And that's what he's talking about, because here I am, I'm so compassionate toward you because you're so weak and helpless, or you're in such a difficult situation. And so I, from my position of separateness, in my generosity of heart, I feel compassion for you. And you can feel that way. But the kindness that he describes here is when you're... I can think of it in my life. I've seen people that I really dislike. I mean, I don't mean personal friends, but people that you really dislike, but you feel like somebody on the street, let's say, who's drunk or schizophrenic, or some of those people that you see just wandering about, and you can feel sorry for them, but to actually walk up to them and have a complete sense of acceptance of their reality, and as he puts it here, that this person is just like me, he's striving for self-improvement, I can just relate to him as a brother and have no barriers between us, you can see that's a different dimension of the expression of positive feeling. I have compassion for a lot of people, but it's not, I can't be kind to them because I just don't have the self-control to be kind to them. My inner aversion to their strangeness, my fear of what they might do to me, my desire not to be taken advantage of. I mean, all these many things could enter into it, which can interrupt the, you know, acts of simple kindness, where the compassion can still be there. Does that make sense? And kindness is a much more innocent quality. Yes, Sharmila? Why don't you just keep it going here? Uh-huh.
It sounds as if you're using the word compassion in the same way as sympathy.
I don't know the distinction.
I think of them as quite different. I think as compassion is very much a heart quality, not with the simplicity that you're talking about, perhaps with kindness, but that there is my ability to be in your shoes, to understand, to feel your circumstances is a heart quality, whereas I think of sympathy as kind of a, oh, that's too bad, I feel sorry for you, sort of a separation.
But I could have a lot of compassion for someone and still not be kind to them. I mean, I'm just speaking for myself. I can even think of instances where I've had a lot of compassion for someone. Just recently, as an example, you know, I mean, let me just not make it so personable, but, well, anyway, here I am. You know, I've had to deal with elderly relative whose mind is not completely normal. And I have great compassion for him, but sometimes he just infuriates the heck out of me, and I'm not the slightest bit kind to him. But even in my lack of kindness to him, I don't have any less compassion for him. You know, I still feel this tremendous sense of sympathy and compassion and heart feeling and all of those things, but I'm not able to have to simply accept him for the condition that he's in. Really, mostly probably because I'm a little bit afraid, or I don't have purity of heart or something. But can you sense the distinction there? It's really quite subtle. But kindness is actually, I think it's also really important, because we mustn't think that compassion is the same as kindness. We mustn't think merely because we have sympathy for people that we're actually still being kind to them. Kindness is such an extraordinarily beautiful quality that it's really worth elevating and understanding it just on its own. I have one particular friend, Kirtani. Some of you know her. She's in Assisi. She's just, I think she's just the kindest person I've ever met. It's just not in her. She can never reason things out to the point where she'll come to the point where she'll be unkind. I can have compassion for someone and then reason it out and then be stern or unkind or a little unforgiving or a little this and that. And that, I mean, on the occasions that I've done that, she just sort of looks at me like, how could you behave that way? And I can see in her eyes, it's just, she has such a sense of everybody, of equal reality with everyone, that she can never be anything except just reach out in this very supportive way. And it's taken me a long time to understand this distinction, because I have a lot of compassion, but I have other qualities that often make me not as kind as I should be. And because I do have compassion, it's taken me a long time to understand that I'm not always kind. I don't mean to turn this into my own session, but because I understand this distinction, can you all understand that? Because I'm smart and I can articulate and maybe I can explain things, so I have compassion for you, so I'll tell you what's wrong with you. And I don't notice how unkind that is, because it seemed like a good idea. But my friend Kirtani has really taught me, and I use her as an inward example. I often think, what would she do? And when I think about her, I can tell that she would never say that, because she's too kind. You know, we might have equal compassion, but she's too kind, she wouldn't do it. So I think Swami's really trying to make sure that we don't mistake just a sense of sympathy or compassion for people for an actual instinctive wish, well, to do no harm, you might say, because they all start weaving together. Does that make it clear, Darlene? Any other questions? Yes, Patrick.
Under fearlessness, it says, fearlessness, on the other hand, comes from releasing those attachments, quite possibly in their reverse order, into the infinite. And one of them that he comes up with is the desire to be well thought of.
Yeah.
And it seems that that's a good one. I don't see a problem with being well thought of. If you're well thought of, you might be able to share knowledge with someone. If you're not well thought of, that seems like not a possibility.
Okay, that's a very good question. You see, aren't these subtle? Aren't these fun? Okay, the actual word is to be well thought of. How does he say it? Self-preservation. Okay. Fearlessness comes from perfect non-attachment. It's a natural attitude. Let me just find the word. Yeah, I just wanted to see. A concern for one's reputation. Over here he describes that it as a desire to be well thought of. But when he's describing it in the positive direction, he says, the more a person's body consciousness, he talks about the fundamental basis of fear is that we are attached to this body. And therefore, that gives us something that we have to protect. Okay, let's trace this through, and we'll come back specifically to your question. So because we have an ego, and the ego defines ourselves in relation to this body, and once we have identified with this body, we see ourselves as individual, or we draw our individuality from our relationship to the body, not from the singularity of being one with the spirit. We draw it from having a body. Now the problem with a body, having a body, is that limits us to one gender, one age, you know, one set of parents, one set of circumstances. So all of a sudden, we have this whole other collected sense of identification that all started because we saw ourselves as a body. Now, to get this clear, if you think about Paramhansa Yogananda or Jesus Christ incarnating, they can incarnate in a body and walk around in it, but even when a master walks around in a body, he never identifies himself with the body in the same sense. He's responsible for it. He recognizes the role it plays. He knows who his parents are in relation to that body. He sees his responsibilities. But his sense of identity is always expanded. He never loses touch with the infinite just because he's in one body, whereas we tend to lose track of our infinite nature because we're in one body. So there's always this undercurrent of anxiety that if anything happens to the individuality that has its origin point with this body, which means the personality, its possessions, this is how Swami says, so you start with a physical body and then your sense of identity expands out to all the things that come with it. My home, my wife, my children, my reputation, my work, all these different things, then we're anxious because if we've defined ourselves by all those things, then our very self can be threatened by the dissolution of any of them. We're still not quite to your question, but we're getting there. Okay? And so we're always going to be a little anxious as long as our well-being and sense of self is dependent on those relationships and attachments. Now, concern for one's reputation is not the same as concern for one's character, or for one's dharma, or for one's right relationship to God, or for the purity or perfection of one's actions. Concern for reputation is concern for how other people perceive us. And how it's not about how we are, it's how we're perceived. And the great difficulty is that other people, all being ego-identified as they are, will tend to perceive us according to the particular set of filters that they're working with. And their appraisal of us may or may not relate to the truth of our righteousness, the truth of our goodness. And once we become concerned about how other people are perceiving us, then we have a whole just sort of endless arena of realities we're trying to hold together that move us farther and farther away from the simple relationship of ourselves to higher truth, of ourselves to Dharma. So yes, it's true that if people respect you, then they may be more inclined to listen to you. I mean, that's sort of a good reason to try to keep a positive reputation. But very often people are idiots. The way Swami said, you know, why care about what people think? Most of the time they're wrong. That's sort of a cynical attitude, but you just have to look at the course of history and you see how people are praised today and forgotten tomorrow, and their reputation is smeared today and then they're resurrected tomorrow, and then in 100 years they're completely forgotten. And insofar as we have put our reliance on trying to keep that external perception intact, we have removed our attention from where it really ought to be. Now, the other side of that, specifically the question you asked, how do we actually influence people? If the question now is, the way you put it, the desire to be well thought of. Okay. If we say that we have the desire to be righteous, then that's an inward desire and it's defined by consciousness. And so what I was getting to there is, how do we really help others? Do we help others by the relationship with their ego, or do we help others by the vibrations of consciousness that we emanate to the world? And so if our first concern is that our vibrations of consciousness be correct, even the desire to help others is going to be fulfilled on a much more profound level if our consciousness, if we've paid attention to our consciousness. Now, it may also happen that we will receive the praise of the world, and then great. But it's just as likely to happen, for example, Jesus Christ, that we will not receive the praise of the world, that we will be, you know, terribly attacked, or maybe we won't be. But it won't. That is not actually the determining factor in whether or not we are able to uplift. We are able to uplift if we have an uplifting vibration. And if we, in whatever else happens is nishkam karma. It's just like whatever happens after that is, we can't control it. And if we're trying to control that, we're always going to be afraid because it's uncontrollable. We're attached to things being a certain way. It's not something that's within our power to control. If we're attached to that, we're always going to be anxious. Is that fair? No? No? Try again. Why don't we not turn it off? Just leave it on.
Jesus might not have been well thought of by a few people while he was alive, but he's pretty well thought of.
Thought of afterwards.
Okay.
Right. But by then he was gone from his body, so there was no level. I mean, first of all, Jesus was never attached. These are conversations about how we live within our present reality, not how history regards us in the future. But history would not have regarded him well. The reason history has regarded Jesus well is because of his consciousness. And in fact, the reason Judas betrayed him is that Judas wanted him to pay more attention to his reputation.
Okay.
Is that fair? I mean, because that's exactly true. I'm not trying to trick you, but that's exactly what happened.
Jesus' long-term goal of being well thought of was part of his nature. It had to be.
You're making it like it was about him. Yeah. Jesus didn't have any desire to be well thought of. Jesus had the desire simply and only to serve God. That was his only desire. And that's the difference. Is that fair?
I'm putting more into it.
Yeah. I mean, even Mother Teresa said something extremely revealing. When people were asking her about the social work that she was doing, you know, how many poor people are you helping? Do you think that you're really making a dent on the poverty of the world? Do you think that your non-religious entities could do more good for the poor than you? They asked her these kinds of questions. She just looked at them. This was on a film that I saw. She just looked at them. She says, I'm not helping the poor. And everyone looks, you know, like, of course you're helping the poor. I'm not helping the poor. She says, I'm doing what Jesus has asked me to do. She just moved it to a completely other dimension. From the outside, people thought she was helping the poor, but helping the poor was a complete side effect of what she was actually doing. And so what the Gita is trying to tell us here is, even if your desire is to be helpful to people, the way to help people is to internalize your consciousness, be in right relationship with higher consciousness, then everything else will follow. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. Is that fair? Yeah, because what you asked is a very reasonable question, and it does need to be understood. Because, see, that comes back to it. I mean, this is not a small thing. Where there is dharma, there is victory. So there's many, many times when we are sorely tempted to try to appease circumstances in some way or another. I don't mean by being entirely dishonest or anything like that. But our inclination is to try to make it okay in some external way. Well, we really can't take that stand because that's so upsetting to these people. We can't do that. We really ought not to do this. I mean, I always end up talking about the lawsuit when you ask me questions somehow, because it's really very important questions. When we were in that intense conflict with SRF, that legal battle, there was a tremendous movement within Ananda. It was not a clear-cut situation at all within Ananda that it wasn't right to fight because it was so upsetting. Caused so much upset to other people. Why should we fight? Well, because it wasn't dharma either to allow our work to be snuffed out. So we had to think about our God-given dharma to serve master required us to do things that otherwise we would not have done. It's not that we were ever dishonorable, but we had to fight, which was not our own nature to fight at all. Our own nature was to say, what difference does it make? But it would have violated a deeper dharma, and so therefore we had to stand up. And that was not by any means an easy situation. We were in that fight for 12 years, and it was a long process for a lot of people to ever come to terms with what we were doing and why we were doing it, because of exactly this kind of reality, but we had to finally just narrow it right down to the very fundamental question. And when we got it to the most fundamental question, we had to say to ourselves, where there is dharma, there is victory. We'll just do what we know to be right, and we'll just pray that everything else works out. And many times you have to do that. You have to stand up. Swami actually wrote it a long time ago, but I just noticed it a few weeks ago. He was talking about why Ananda was so fiercely attacked and why we had to fight so hard. He said, Master wants us to be warriors for the light, not to live in the self-image that many devotees at Ananda have of themselves is just sweet devotees. You know, many people prefer the picture of just being a sweet devotee, but it wasn't the right self-image. We had to be, as he put it, warriors for the light. In other words, you had to choose an inward reality over concern for everything. Fair enough? We had to be fearless, too, because we were in danger of losing everything we didn't know. But it didn't matter, because we had to do it anyway. Okay? Any other questions? Are you satisfied? Or are you just silenced? All right. Well, that was number one. Number two is purity of heart, which comes when one has removed from his heart any feeling that is foreign to his true nature. He describes it as an absence of selfish or ulterior motive, guilelessness. He bears no malice. And then he says, very sweetly, he says, purity, with this purity alone, you'll manifest all the other spiritual qualities. And this is, if you think of the Bible where it says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. In the Beatitudes, he lists all these qualities, and if you behave this way, then this will happen. If you're in sorrow, if you're compassionate, you will receive sympathy, and if you're righteous, these things will come. If you're humble, then, but if you're pure of heart, then you'll see the kingdom of God. And purity of heart is, every Sunday morning, for those of you who participate, but we have, during our 9 o'clock meditation, we have what Swami called the purification ceremony. And when he created that ceremony, which was almost 20 years ago now, he had this little thing on the little sheet of paper he gave us that explained it. It said at top, in lieu of confession, is what it said, purification ceremony, because the Festival of Light was sort of like the Mass a little bit, and then there was the purification. And Swamiji was explaining to us that he really wanted us to shift our emphasis, because this is the shift from Kali Yuga into Dwapara Yuga. The Kali Yuga concept of spirituality, based on a whole lot of misunderstandings, but a lot from the Christian, and especially the Christian tradition, is that there's this something fundamentally wrong with us. And a lot of the Christian theology is that, you know, we come up from the animals, we're tainted by original sin, and only by the grace of God are we relieved of the burden that otherwise is inherently ours. That the whole evolution is up from the animal level and we just barely rise above it. The tradition from India is that our true nature is infinite, and that purity and bliss is who we really are, and then we descend and get ourselves covered with mud. But as they often say, a diamond, even surrounded by coal, is unaffected. No matter how dense that darkness is, the diamond remains untainted. And so the principle of purity of heart is that if we just stopped being confused, what we really are inside is pure light. We just have to take away that which is, as he puts it, foreign to our true nature. You see what an important difference that is? An important distinction? Instead of saying, I've done this wrong, I've done that wrong, please forgive me, absolve me of these sins which are my nature. You know, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. That's how it goes. And then the priest tells you, you can do this, and then those sins would adhere to you anymore. But the whole mindset is to think about all the things that I've done wrong, which of course orients us that way. I know our Catholic friends, some of them tell me about being little boys and just really literally having to make up sins to tell the priest because you had to go to confession and you had to have done something wrong. So the mindset was always, and it was a joke for them, but still the mindset was, well, I must have done something wrong. I'm just not paying enough attention. And so, and the theology was that, because this is the saving power of Jesus Christ who rescues us. Whereas the self-realization is, I am the bright light, and I've just gotten a little dust on me. Let me just wipe it off. Let me just remove that which is adhering to me, which isn't actually me. And you can see how as soon as you do that, there it is. What's left? Once you remove the coal, the diamond is there. The diamond does not have to be created. And if we can really deeply just get into that childlike innocence, and it's a very important quality to, I want to say, fight for. You know, don't let anything, any thought, any habit, any karmic inclination within you, anybody else's point of view, ever persuade you that you're anything but a diamond with a little dust on you. And this, you know, lack of malice, lack of selfishness, just guilelessness, just be childlike in our spirit. You know, Ananda does a lot of things that are seem very childlike to people, childish almost. But it's just sort of, we have a guileless nature. We're not here to prove that we're sophisticated. We're not here to show people how, you know, how discriminating we are and how we can see through all these things and just all the kind of stuff people put on. You know, dressing all up and going around looking like a fancy person and it's just like, why? You know, just be there for us little children. I remember Arati and I once, this was like 25 years ago, we were traveling in Denver. We were trying to promote Swami's upcoming visit to that city. He was coming about a month behind us. And we had gotten an invitation to this reception. It was actually a reception for some very famous jazz musician whose name escapes me. But all the, for some reason, all the New Age, quote, community was going to be there. And it was in a very, very fancy mansion. And Arati and I were really humble little country devotees. I can't remember what we were wearing, but I'm certain it was not in fashion and not at all impressive. And we just, you know, we just didn't operate in that world. We weren't born in it. We never lived in it. So we're standing on the doorstep of this mansion with all these fancy cars. And we're just a little nervous. And then Arati turns to me and she says, childlike joy is always in fashion. Yeah. And then we laughed and rang the doorbell and, you know, went in, actually had a very nice time, met some lovely people that night, met some people who became very good friends of ours, in fact. But it was just that moment. It's like the world tries to take you over and put all these thoughts into your mind and you have to just keep going back to that guilelessness. What does it matter? I am just a child of God. Why do I have to pretend that I'm anything else? I don't have to be something I'm not. And something I'm not is everything but that. That's all that's foreign to our nature. Isn't that lovely? Okay, number three is perseverance. I love the way he describes perseverance, the continuous reapplication of willpower with an ever new and creative outlook. So he doesn't describe perseverance as just merely endurance. You see, there's a great deal of difference. I bought some curtains in India a few years ago, and I had to put curtain rods up in my house. And I am not a person who uses tools. I have opposable thumbs, but I'm not a person who uses tools as a rule. But for some reason, I just felt that I was going to do this myself. One of my friends continually points out in the guest room how one of the curtain rods is slanted. She's always telling me it's slanted. I always tell her proudly I did it myself, and that's why it's slanted. Why is it slanted? Because I put it up there. But it turned out to be an extraordinary spiritual lesson for me because I've done zero carpentry in my whole life, and I had to, you know, make holes in the wall and have the holes be in the wrong place, and then I had to spackle and paint and, you know, all those little things that you do. But because the project was so outside anything that I know how to do, I discovered the generic nature of work, which is the patient, continuous application of willpower. And I just saw that, and I realized that all projects are the patient, continuous application of willpower, added to with the the willingness to look for an ever new solution, which in fact I kept having to do because I kept screwing the thing up, and so I had to figure out how to do it again in a different way, and what was I going to do now? But this is one of the divine qualities, and the more we can not become sidetracked and confused and think that something else is happening, most of the time, if you have any difficulty in your life, perseverance is all that you need. But he does add this wonderful quality because he distinguishes perseverance from stubbornness. Stubbornness is something quite different. Stubbornness is just being fixed in your point of view and not being willing to consider new realities. Stubbornness can lack creativity. And I mean, I know sometimes people use these words a little interchangeably, but here the subtleties are important. We need to persevere, but part of perseverance, as he puts it, is the willingness to re-examine our position and, if necessary, to correct it. It's not a lessening of our determination or our output to be willing to stop and ask, well, okay, I don't want to just stubbornly drive my head against the brick wall. I want to ask if this is actually where the door is to the room, out of the room or not. So it's really gorgeous. If you ever deal with the I Ching, many years ago before I came to Ananda, the I Ching passed through my life. Virtually every one of whatever they call their verses, perseverance furthers is the word that they always say. The first line always is perseverance. Partly because, you see, our true nature is divine. And if we simply persevere in the true meaning of perseverance, which is not just stubborn ignorance, but creative reapplication of willpower over and over again, then we must succeed. Isn't it a marvelous quality? Sattvic charity, Swami expands from not just the giving of alms, because he doesn't just say charity, it says sattvic charity, which means charity could also be rajasic, it could even be tamasic, because as he describes here, sometimes people give in order to, as he puts it, put people under an obligation to you. So he says, first of all, it means to be generous in one's opinion of others. Don't you love the way he backs it all the way up? The true charity is to be charitable in your opinions, to be kind. Again, we come back to the word kindness, and he uses the same explanations in many ways to get us to this state of mind, because we realize that everybody is doing the best they can and they're not that different than us. And so it's a compassion and an understanding born of experience, and it's a charity born of the experience also of what it feels like to not receive a charitable opinion from others. You know, the reason we have negative experiences is, first of all, because we've dished them out at some time or another in the past, and we're just getting our own back. And the other thing is so that we will feel it and then recognize the consequences of our own action. You know, it's a very powerful thing to be hurt and then later to recognize when our sense of self expands enough to see others also as having the same feelings we do, and then we can remember what it felt like to be treated that way. And our sense of compassion and kindness toward people comes from having really literally walked in their shoes. And or we can be compassionate toward those things that we are no longer afraid of. If we have fear, we want to try to obliterate them, and it makes us, kindness is more difficult. That's sort of a second thought. But then he also gives us lessons for how to give charity. It's an interesting thought. Don't give too much and always allow the person to have a dignified response instead of just burying them under your superiority. Swami tells that story from his childhood in Romania when he had this great compassion for these boys because they didn't have anything. And he gave them his toys and so on. And then this crowd of poor children turned on him and actually almost beat him up. But they decided not to, and he escaped. But Swamiji describes how he wept in his mother's arms. He was just a young lad, because he had tried so hard to be kind to them, and instead they were angry with him. But then he realized later that he had demeaned them by just giving them too much without giving them any way to have the dignity of returning the favor. It's a very interesting point in terms of charity altogether about how we really can and should work with people and help people. And then also often there's some ulterior motive, and other people will feel that ulterior motive. Either we're trying to assuage a sense of guilt or as he puts it here, we're trying to get them obligated to us. And I started trying to think from the other side why some people find it difficult to receive, either because they feel it takes away their dignity or they don't want to be obligated to others. They don't trust the charity because the charity may put them under an obligation they don't want to be under. You know, that, because that's a whole different discussion. Any questions or thoughts about that? Self-restraint. Self-restraint, he writes so interestingly. We tend to think of self-restraint as meaning denying ourselves experiences. But that's, as Swami says, that's such a dry approach. Well, you know, I'm not going to eat this good food. I'm not going to have a sexual relationship. I'm not going to wear pretty clothes. I'm not going to go to the movies. I'm not going to do this. Swamiji says so many people define spirituality and renunciation in terms of all the things they don't have. And you see how, what a mindset that gets to be. And then sometimes the fact that you've denied yourself all these things just cause you to think about them all the time. Swami Master talks about that. People go away to caves to renounce the world, but they bring the world with them. And they spend the whole time in their austerity just contemplating all the things that they don't have in one way or another. So he describes self-restraint as completely different, which is in the midst of whatever it is that's bringing you joy, two realities. One is, always realize that the real source of your happiness is from within. And it's your capacity for joy that you're experiencing, perhaps awakened in you by this external experience, but it's always your own consciousness that you're always experiencing. And so then he says, don't ever let yourself go completely, but always keep a part of yourself inwardly aware of the fact that, you know, the divine self is experiencing this, instead of losing all consciousness in the enjoyment of the party or the wildness of the dance or the intensity of the passion. You know, there's the opposite is what we're always counseled to do, which is just, you know, give in completely. But if we always hold that personal dignity, even in the midst of everything else that's happening, then we may still live in the same way, but we're gradually re-educating our inner self. We're re-educating ourselves to understand that, in a sense, ultimately, I don't really need any of this, because all I'm really experiencing is my inner self. But then when it falls away from us, it's not then this thought that it really would have given us so much happiness, but Lord, I can't have it. It's rather just the realization that I don't need that to be happy. If it comes to me, that's fine. If it doesn't, it's fine. And even in the doing of it, I never lose my contact with the divine. It's a very interesting way to live, and it's also a very interesting way to live, especially because most of us are compelled by desires we can't restrain, you know, either in massive or small ways. I mean, if you're a drug addict or a sex addict or a whatever kind of an overwhelming, or an ice cream addict, you know, and just have a completely uncontrollable desire to do it or to go to nightclubs when you don't really want to, and you find yourself doing it, practice this dimension of self-restraint, where even in the midst of doing it, you never separate yourself from your inner self. Another way of putting that, as Swami puts it, is to take Divine Mother with you. Okay, we're going to go down to the Tenderloin tonight. We're going down to places you've never seen very much, but of course she's seen it. She lives everywhere, you know, and you keep just a little part of you connected to your highest self, and in that way you're planting the seeds of eventual actual overcoming, often much more than with this really sort of hard... people get so divided against themselves, and that really doesn't bring you anything. It really doesn't work. I've never yet met anyone. I mean, I've met many people who come to me and say, well, I need to do this, and I'm going to do this, and can you help me do that? And I usually say, probably not. You know, because you can just almost tell from that brittleness that this is not really the number that's up. You know, we're trying to avoid instead of just finding our solid ground and then moving forward like that. Doesn't mean you shouldn't resist with all your heart the things that you know are not good for you. But do it by practicing self-restraint as he describes it. The performance of sacred rites. Let's take a short break before we go on, okay? We have the concept. It's called the performance of sacred rites. And Swamiji explains, which is very important to understand, that this is listed as a quality, and it looks like an action, so it has to mean the attitude behind that. And he describes it, first of all, he says, this is an autobiography of a yogi too, that ritual will not free you from delusion because ritual is not the antidote to delusion. Delusion is a state of mind and ritual is merely an action. I often think about that. And so he's answering, in this sense, he's answering the misunderstanding primarily in the Indian culture that the rituals are required or that a ritual alone can accomplish something. He does say, you know, that offering oblations with Sanskrit mantras will help you attune to subtle aspects of vibration, and especially with the cosmic Om. In other words, by repeating in your own mind or being in the company of where these holy words are spoken actually creates a certain vibration, and that vibration can harmonize your own self. We are sound vibrations, and the right kind of sound vibrations put our system into order. That's why sacred music has such a profound effect on us. That's why spending a long time chanting, and then suddenly you can just meditate almost effortlessly, because the chanting has just harmonized basically the whole system, and then stillness is just an automatic thing. Sometimes it's quite remarkable in the middle of our Friday kirtans, even very, very energetic, at least it's my experience, seemingly outward kirtans with a lot of rajasic energy, as soon as we stop, it's just absolutely still. And the mind is absolutely still because the mantras have raised our vibration. So it can lead you to deep experiences, but it's not in itself the antidote to delusion, because it all depends on what the attitude that we're doing it with. So then he describes mental self-offering of heart and mind is the highest sacrifice. And it may not need any external ritual. It's just the constant self-offering that's represented by putting the ghee in the fire or the rice in the fire or whatever it is that we're burning up. But what's really being burned up is we're taking our egoic self and we're offering it into a higher reality. We are constantly affirming. This morning I was called by a writer who's doing a story on stress. And my name is out there as someone who can say something about stress, and she was trying to write it from a spiritual point of view. And sort of at the end, she was asking me, is there anything else that I wanted to say? And I was saying that we were talking about the difficult times that are coming to the world right now. And what has happened to our entire culture is that as we have gradually lost faith, collectively lost faith in the power, in the effort to separate ourselves from dogmas that told us we were worthless and only God had power, we've gradually developed an appreciation of our own inner force and our own inner potential, which is very positive. But we've developed that too far, so that we've begun to think that the human ego is the most powerful force in the universe. And even that if we just collect enough human egos that all think the same thing, then we will run the whole universe. But the fact of the matter is, the more intuitively we know that just myself and my own mind, even with all these promises of my power, we intuitively sense that there's just forces that are so much greater than I am. Earthquakes, fire, flood, famine, unleveraged, overleveraged bankers, whatever all these things are, we see it all around us. We see, you know, fanatics in other countries. There's just so many things that we just know the ego can't master, and no amount of anybody trying to tell us that we can really works, because intuitively we know it's false. And so we live, the biggest stress of our society at this time is the lack of attunement to the fact that there are higher realities and we are just instruments of those realities, and that the whole destiny of this world is really not just in our hands. And rather than making us insecure, that's actually where, that's the greatest alleviation of stress that there is to realize that I'm part of a greater reality, that this is a complex tapestry and I'm just one thread in it. And I need to play my part as well as I can, but with an intuitive experience of this benign guiding force. And because we're just not put in circumstances where we're in tune with that anymore, we're gradually, deeply, profoundly losing touch with it. That's also what allows such atrocities to happen and such unbridled greed. Because if it's just about what I can do, why don't I just do it? There's no hell, there's no damnation. In the West, there's not even any reincarnation. If I can just get away with it, I can do it. And it's a terrifying way to live and the ultimate cause of stress. So when we're talking here about the performance of sacred rites, it's really even understanding that our life itself is a sacred rite. This is a divine opportunity that's been given to me, the little bird we talk about on Sundays. You know, I'm given this mission to be fruitful and to multiply and to share with others what was given to me. Just as God, as my maker has given me my life, it's my sacred duty to offer that life into the great river of creation and as an uplifting force. So it's an attitude of mind. It's a wonderful attitude of mind, the self-offering, the mental self-offering of heart as well as mind up to a higher reality. That's what everything else represents. Then he talks about study of the scripture, and he explains that again. It means reverence for the scriptures. And this is another point, again, that we're just losing in our culture. And coming back to these timeless truths is what we really need. We need to have reverence for the fact that there is great wisdom that has been handed down through the ages, and that these sacred texts and sacred examples are really there. And it is not just a question of whether I like it or not. I had the most shocking and disturbing experience when I was counseling this man who was in terrible trouble financially. I mean, he was in such a mess. And sort of almost as a last resort, he just came to talk to me, hoping I could help him do something. So I suggested to him that given that his financial situation was so disastrous and so seemingly out of his control, he really ought to tithe. I mean, quite apart from whether or not he could tune into that, which was not the issue. I said 10%. He said, why? He said, where did that come from? I said, well, that was when Moses was on Mount Sinai, tithing 10%. One sheep out of every 10, you know, one bushel of wheat out of every 10 should be given to the priests and to the temple, is how it was put. And I said, so that's a message Moses got on Mount Sinai along with the other 10 that are better known. And he said, how do you know that? I said, well, it's written in the Bible. Well, somebody wrote it in the Bible, but how do you know it was really what Moses said? And it wasn't even his questioning that. It was the fierceness of his question and the complete loss on his part of any intuitive reverence for the tradition of spirituality and the deep suspicion that even something so fundamental as the story of Moses on Mount Sinai could, after all, just be a sham. And I felt so badly for him. And there was really absolutely nothing I could do, because his determination to reject it was far greater than my capacity to give him faith. So this reverence for the scriptures, and it's not something you can force on people. If you sit and read the Bible, I mean, I've found when I sit and read the Bible, when I sit and read this book, which is a scripture, and it's not just about a scripture, it's a scripture. If you're receptive, you feel it. And that's why I think this experience of these classes has been so unusual, because we're just in the presence of, this is Master's Paramahansa Yogananda's interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita. We have Krishna, Yogananda, and then the scribe, Swami Kriyananda, doing all this. And I mean, there's a lot of juice in this. And we feel it. And so there's a reverential attitude that just comes out of your heart. And when we are gifted enough to sense it, by all means, realize what you've been given. Have the purity of heart to not doubt that, but just move into that. That's why people can read the Bible over and over. There's just the power and the presence of God in it. You feel it. And so what he's saying is, as you advance spiritually, your sensitivity develops and you automatically have this feeling. And he says, don't be guileless. Pay attention to the wisdom of the ages. Don't be credulous, I mean, not guileless. I've just been appreciating so much how our culture's lack of faith has brought us to this present mess, and how the result of the present mess, which meaning the war and the economic troubles and so many things that are falling apart in our society. As Swami said so sweetly on Saturday night, the world is falling apart, but don't worry, God is holding it together. Is that we will be shown the limits of the ego's power. And what is good is that we have reclaimed our responsibility, and we're not passive now. That's been the positive dimension of this. We've pushed it too far, and what's going to happen is we're going to recognize that we're not in control, and first out of fear and then later out of devotion, people are going to write their energy relationship to the infinite. I know when someone came to Ananda and really wanted us to take a strong stand in the ecological movement because, you know, we're a lot of organized energy. Swami's answer was, he said, if everyone lived the way we lived, we wouldn't have any of these problems. And he didn't necessarily mean that we have a small carbon footprint or anything like that. He meant if people remembered their devotion and to the presence of God, then everything else follows from that. The kind of abuses that you see are simply not possible if you see yourself as part of the greater whole. In the way of Ananda Sanghi, Swamiji states that everything is made of Satchitananda, and all creatures are united by a bond of mutual service. It's just so beautifully stated, and it just encompasses everything. When we were talking about the green movement and how Ananda could participate, I was saying, well, no, we can do our part, but we need to do it in our way. And what we pointed to was all creatures are bound by a bond of mutual service. And you see, and then all of a sudden, everything comes into order, but it comes into order from the right point of view. It's not just us desperately trying to, you know, tell the poor people in Brazil that they can't cut down those trees, that they need to keep them there for our sake. It just gets all, and then you're always just fighting, and you can't follow lots of other qualities in here. But if you think in terms of mutual service, then it just directs the whole, but you end up at the same place. But you get there from the angle that you want to come to it. Number 8 is self-discipline. And Swami just reminds us to be moderate in all things. Number 9 is straightforwardness. Don't you love these words? Straightforwardness. It's just not it's like an old-fashioned virtue to be straightforward, isn't it? And he says, completely honest and truthful in all your dealings. Just don't cut corners, is how he puts it. Don't negotiate. Just be straightforward. I know you have to be diplomatic and you have to be smart, but you should also be straightforward. Any corners that you cut will only weaken your powers of accomplishment, weaken your ability to persevere. It's just so simple because it puts you out of integrity. And all of a sudden, you're relying only on the ego. You no longer have what Swami calls elsewhere the sounding board of the universe behind you. When you're completely dharmic, then you're in harmony with the universe itself. When you're not, you've just put yourself in harmony only with your own ego and its little desires. And immediately, you have to protect what you've separated. You're back up into fearlessness, fearfulness, and all these other things come forward. Harmlessness, he says, is not passive, but it's the desire not to try to wrest from life what the ego wants. When this woman asked me today what stress is, how do I define stress? I said, stress is when life is trying to take you in one direction and you're trying to go in another direction. The tension that can result when life is moving in one direction and you're determined to go in another. Now, that's completely different than a high aspiration. By that, I meant simply when we don't want to deal with reality. Now, remember, in others that come here is the ability to face reality as it is. That's truthfulness. That's the one that comes next. Okay? So when we try to wrest from life what the ego wants, that is not the same as having high aspirations and right dharmic ambitions and persevering. Harmlessness is giving up the thought that if it doesn't go our way, we're going to make it go our way from the ego point of view. And so then we come to truthfulness. All these work together. He said it might be included under straightforwardness, he says, but it has the further connotation of not wishing reality to be other than it is. Oh, it's very, very subtle, isn't it? You know, to be completely truthful is to just be able to see things as they are. And then make right decisions. That doesn't mean that we don't ever, as he says, only when we face reality as it is can we begin to make it what it ought to be. If we don't face it, we can't influence it because we're never working with intelligent response to what's actually going on. He uses the example, if, for instance, we've spoken rudely, we can only become gentler after we've faced up frankly to the fact that we have done the wrong thing. If we have a desire to be a success in business, let's say, but we lack the fundamental understanding of how the laws of money magnetism work, but if we just keep affirming that I'm going to be a success, we haven't yet faced the reality. We don't yet have the skills to make that thing a success. Do you see what I mean? And until we can just look honestly and truthfully at what's really happening, then we can begin to influence things. But, I mean, the hardest, I'm sure you found this too, the hardest situation to deal with in other people is when they can't see what's actually happening. You know, if someone is not truthful about themselves, it's almost impossible to help them because whatever you suggest, they'll just tell you it's not true. You just can't go anywhere. And in our own lives, it's the same thing, isn't it? If we're not willing to accept. I mean, I've just been amazed as the years go by. Every so often, I'll just wake up and realize some fundamental aspect of myself that I was never able to see before. And I can see how difficult I've made my life by not being able to face reality. And gradually, as one learns to, everything just gets so much easier. Well, because you have so much less to protect, there's so much less fear, all of these other things. It's a profoundly important quality. Freedom from anger comes from not desiring anything from others. In other words, from not, it's the same point of view, from not trying to make the world into what you want it to be, but being able to be truthful in what you see. He also says, anger creates a disturbance and an unsettling influence in the brain. Isn't that interesting? Even if you don't express it, that thought of thwarted desire, which makes you feel like the world has done something to you, you see you're out of integrity with the truth then, because the world never does anything to you. It just gives you back exactly what you've woven into it. I love the picture of a tapestry. I mean, I think of something like the Bayeux tapestry, something very, very long in which we've cut out this little square and called it this incarnation. You know, but the threads have been woven from that direction and are going to be woven this direction and are going up and down. And we're just right in this little tiny picture. And we think that this shouldn't have happened and that shouldn't have happened and they should have done this and I want them to do that. And it makes me so mad like this. And then unsettling influence in the brain. And so it's like, it's not, that's, some people say, well, you should give in to these things, you should express these things. You should not hide from these things. You need to be truthful. If you're angry, it doesn't serve anything to say no. You have to be truthful. You have to see reality as it is. I am a person who's inclined to become very angry. If that's the truth, you need to say it. That person's action has infuriated me. If that's the truth, you have to say it. But we also have to understand that it's unsettling and it disturbs the brain, and therefore, what will I do about it? Because merely just expressing it just unsettles the brain. So we need to be truthful also about the effect of anger on us. We have to, you know, we have to play all this out in balance with itself. Renunciation is transcending ego-inspired motive, nishkam karma, which means action without desire for the fruits of action. And he says it must be primarily of the heart. It doesn't do us again to put on a show. It just means inwardly to recognize that selfishness doesn't pay. Tranquility under all circumstances, to be centered in the inner self. Nothing is permanent. Then he gives us as the way to do that is to realize that nothing lasts forever. I've been contemplating that a great deal. No matter what happens, it doesn't last. Absolutely nothing lasts. Just really, just think about it. Nothing lasts. I was talking to a young girl. She was talking about how the last couple of months have just flown by. I said, honey, you have no idea how it just flies by. It's a very hard attitude to have when you've only been in your body for a couple of decades. But the more decades you're in your body, the more easy it is to see. I actually spend a lot of time, and I think this is a worthwhile practice. Not a lot of time, but it's a regular practice of mine. On the assumption that I will inhabit another body, that this isn't it, and this isn't the last round for me, I try to impress deeply on my mind and on a much deeper than conscious level the perception that I have now, that I realize is that I didn't have in my youth, that the conditions of youth might obscure. I try to just really deeply hold those thoughts and visualize myself as a teenager, as a child in my 20s, and try to give myself a deep enough understanding of the ephemeral nature of life, of the capacity to endure because everything changes, of just being tranquil because what difference does it make? It all changes in the end anyway, and trying to hold those attitudes at a younger age. I hope it's a worthwhile practice. It seems so to me. My friend said that when she was 10, she didn't have any philosophical reason for saying this at the time, but she remembers saying out loud to herself, "Being a child is not all that much fun. Don't forget." And now she looks back and realizes what she was doing. This inclination toward fault finding, that's such a sweet statement, isn't it? A disinclination toward fault finding. We're always just looking around and criticizing. The mind is so eager to put others down and to make it their fault and to have it not be mine and to focus on the negative. Swami often tells us how Master was very strong about not letting them speak of negative things, even when it didn't affect anybody. And nothing was hurt. It hurt you. It hurt the person to focus on negative things. And so the inclination to find fault, again, well, being with some elder people lately has really taught me, because I see that as you get older and your brain gets less flexible, it just starts repeating whatever it's been doing for a really long time. And one of my elder relatives has been a fault finder. And so it's just so sad to see at this stage of his life that he's still criticizing things and people and situations. It's just so, like, where is this going to take us? But that's been a life pattern. It's just made me, like, just shrink back with horror, because any such inclination, the more you repeat it, the more you will repeat it. So you have to overcome the inclination to find fault, and kindness to all, it's the same one. Accept situations and people as they are. The simple acceptance of others. Just deeply, with the deepest part of our nature, just look and see God. And it's not our problem. The only responsibility we have is to be an uplifting influence. And just think of it the other way. When you're down and out or have really messed up, I mean, oh, the milk of human kindness. Don't you just drink it in with desperate joy? When somebody's just genuinely understanding of you, doesn't that help more than anything? And just think how nice it is to be on the receiving end, and what a blessing it is to be the giver. Non-covetousness, not wanting anything that's not yours, gentleness. Modesty is a beautiful one here too. Not trying to draw attention to yourself. And then he makes a very strong distinction that it's not about self self-abnegation. To be modest is not to say, I'm not really. You can't be thinking that. No, of course I'm not. Because the word is I. All the energy keeps coming. And he says it here, maybe it's in a different one, where he says, if a person who does something well doesn't know they do it well, there must be something wrong with them. The point is that we just don't try to make the world revolve around us. Modesty of dress, modesty of manner. Modesty is not a quality, especially modesty of dress, that's very much respected today, but it will be a great relief to all of us when it comes back. You know, I have a very hard time with the excessive self-exposure that many women consider to be attractive. I guess I'm too much of a nun. Even when I was young, I never could ever see it. I was kind of a wild hippie, but I could never see it. Because I could never think, why would you want to call attention to yourself that way? It just it's felt wrong to me, and I deplore, you know, the trend. I live with it. You know, everybody's like that. It's just not worth worrying about. But modesty is a beautiful quality. Why try to draw attention, undue attention to yourself? Why try to be the center of attention? Why try to shock people? Why try to get everybody's eyes on you or on parts of your body that perhaps everybody's eyes shouldn't be on, you know? It's just like, what are we thinking, you know? It's a very important thing to think about. Steadfastness of purpose, he describes, is very similar to perseverance. Radiance of character. Forgiveness is also just a gorgeous one here. He writes it out in such extreme detail. He says when you forgive someone, it shouldn't rankle in your heart. You should forget the offense to you. But you shouldn't be so forgetful that you don't realize what the character is of the person that you're dealing with. Swami is very much like that. It's very interesting. He said, that's just to be naive. If somebody has a character fault and has revealed it to you, you don't have to hold it against them. You don't have to hold them at a distance, but you should behave appropriately in relation to that person. If you know that this person has a tendency to steal, it would be foolish to give him access to money. It wouldn't be good for him to give him access to money. But the forgiveness is because of the kindness, is because of the understanding that everyone is struggling. And it also doesn't hold us up above. I'm forgiving you. Forgiving can be so much about ego. You should accept him for what he is, forgive him, in other words, but behave toward him in the future with appropriate awareness and common sense. And sometimes that means you have to withdraw. Fortitude and patience. Cleanliness is also an interesting one. He calls cleanliness an indication of self-respect and a regard for the feelings of others. I remember Swamiji was, I was actually making some notes because a number of women and men have just told me, we're having a conversation, a group of people who'd known Swami for a long time, and we were all suddenly comparing notes about how often he'd corrected our appearance, even to the point of saying, those colors don't match, that print doesn't suit you, you know, I don't think you should perm your hair. I mean, and it's not like as a rule he's doing that, but this was like a conversation of like over many years, because he's very sensitive to the self-respect issue and the idea of presenting yourself in a way that is harmonious and pleasing to others. And that's not the same as vanity. There was this one woman at a time when Ananda was, we were so poor and we were so country, just almost no one dressed nicely. But this one woman who didn't have any more money than anyone else always looked lovely and always went to a great deal of trouble to make herself look attractive. And she wasn't vain. Swami just often praised her. He said, she's very considerate. He said, because after all, it's others who have to look at you. And when you go around unkempt or rumpled or just without concern for creating an attractive demeanor, it's not necessarily a sign of lack of ego. It's very often, it's just a sign of tamasic energy. And tamasic energy is ego binding. Very often people look like that because they're just too lazy. Or, as he put it, they lack the self-respect to present themselves in a dignified way as a child of God, not in an immodest manner. But if you see people who are messy and unkempt, it's not inspiring as a rule, is it? If you see people who are immodest in the ways that we're describing, and not, I don't just mean lewd, but drawing too much attention to themselves by their dress. David and I went to a wedding, and two of the guests were models. Man, oh man, those girls, they came in together, and they, you know, they spent their whole time just being models, and they were so, look at me, don't you just envy us because we're so beautiful. I mean, it was just almost unbearable just to be anywhere near them. And they weren't immodestly dressed in the sense of being lewd particularly, but they were so into themselves, it was just appalling. But then at the same time, you're not inspired if somebody comes in and they're just a mess. You just, why would you impose that on others? And it's a very important balance point. And Even Swami said, I think it was when he, I don't remember now whether it was Master or Anandamoyi Ma, but I think it was Swami who appeared in front of Master in a torn t-shirt, I think, or else he appeared in front of Anandamoyi Ma, and Master or whoever said, you know, we're not that poor. don't like that. It's just not appropriate. It has low vibes. Swami Chidananda put it that way also. Swami Chidananda came to Ananda, and there was Ananda village, and there was a lot that was a mess. He said lower astral entities are attracted to these vibrations. And so for ourselves, if we're not harmonious, or if we're dirty, or too sloppy even, it attracts lower astral entities because they like that kind of chaos. And so it's very important to be dignified in our appearance. It's very interesting. Swamiji is always, always dressed nicely. I mean, in the privacy of his own home when he's completely alone, but even then. But whenever he goes out in public, he always knows he's representing Master. That's how I feel about it. He's always Master's disciple, and he always knows that as he presents himself, he's presenting his guru to the world. And that's been a very, very helpful thought for me. There's never a time when I'm not representing Master, because you never know in what circumstance you're going to have the opportunity to talk to them about your guru, and you want to be representing him in a way that you can be proud of. So it's not for yourself. It's a very important point. Malice, the absence of malice, again, kindness and forgiveness, the same point keeps circling around. Then the last one is the absence of self-conceit. Well, this is where he talks about, and self-conceit is not the same as pride necessarily. He says it means to entertain and not merely to have certain ideas about oneself. I love the way he says that. So that's where he writes, a famous singer would be deficit in something if he didn't know he was good at singing. But if he entertains the thought of how good he is at singing, then he sets himself up because he thinks it matters in the great scheme of things, and then he sets himself up for a fall. I love that thought, entertaining those thoughts. So it's all right to know that we've accomplished something and done something well, but if we constantly go back to those ideas and draw satisfaction from our successes and then think that we're really important because we are, then we set ourselves up for a fall. Aren't those wonderful? Yeah, put them up on the wall if you must. At least go back and read them often and use them as a yardstick of right consciousness. And I think that we can all grow a lot from that. Okay, anything else before we give it up for the night?